this is the Angry GM, and this is the Angry GM's mostly monthly live chat for the month of November, which is mostly over. This is happening a little late in the month because I had to kind of squeak it in. As many of you know from the updates that I've posted recently, I'm still playing catch up, which is taking a lot longer than I had hoped. It's really hard. This is, you know, not life advice, but here's the thing. It's easier to keep things clean than it is to clean them. Okay, just remember that. You know, just general thing. It's easier to maintain habits than it is to fix them. Anyway, but not life advice. Anyway, so this is it. This is the mostly monthly live chat for November, and I really have no topics to discuss because I've basically been working about 80% of the time just on catching up and getting my article release schedule back to the Wednesdays that it's supposed to be. Tomorrow is really going to test that. But if I get past tomorrow, then next week it's good. But I have an ugly feeling that tomorrow being Wednesday the 23rd, what is going to be posted is an announcement that the article is probably coming on Friday. We'll see. It's just taking a little bit longer than expected, and I'm still having, we're going to call it trouble with my living situation, with necessarily being able to guarantee a proofread aloud right now. That will resolve itself for certain in 2 weeks, at the beginning of December. But right now I have actually managed to put the proofread alouds out and even do them live here on the Discords. Which, by the way, if you're a member of the Discord and listening to this recording and you don't know that this happens, when I am recording a proofread aloud now, if it is possible, I will announce, usually with a 2-hour window, like, hey, I'm recording the proofread aloud, and I'm going to go ahead and throw open the voice chat on Discord so you can all listen to me do the proofread aloud. And then you can discover that it sounds like the crap that actually gets recorded, you know? But then usually the people who have hung out and listened live get an opportunity to ask a few questions and prod for comments, on the article, which I have also been recording and releasing as a separate little, it's not really a separate podcast. It's a supplemental episode. So now there's a proofread aloud and there's a supplemental Q&A proofread aloud that came from the people who hung out and listened to me while I was proofreading aloud in the first place. So just be aware that that happens. And once life is back on some sort of a schedule again, that'll usually happen mid-Friday afternoon, like 2 o'clock my time, 1 o'clock my time, around there. So sometime in the morning, I'll announce, hey, probably doing a proofread aloud today. But lately they've been happening on the day I released the article, and mainly that happens because I suddenly have the opportunity to do them and also feel tremendously guilty that I've been trying to cut out the proofread alouds, or have been struggling to actually get them out. And like I said, there's a number of reasons for that. I don't want to go into all the shit. I don't want to keep rehashing. Like, this is every obstacle that I face. Okay, everybody's got friggin' obstacles in their lives, and you don't pay me to listen to me complain about mine. So, life obstacles happen. I'm dealing with it. Thanks for your patience. There. Okay. So, all of that being said, I have nothing else to discuss tonight. Because right now I am working on articles, working on a module, and working on the future. But that might be my new email signature, says Nitsua. We all have obstacles in our lives. I'm dealing with mine. Thanks for your patience. Yeah. you know, I mean, this is the thing. And a lot of content creators fall into this trap of forgetting that everybody has obstacles in their life. And just because you're a content creator on the internet and you have people who want to listen to you, that doesn't mean that, you know, your obstacles are somehow special or different or anything else, you know, or worse or better. And I do try to maintain that perspective. The problem is, like, I run into a conflict between my innate desire for transparency and my wanting to not bother you with the minutia of shit that's getting in my way. Okay. And so it's like, I feel like if I'm going to update you and say, hey, this is going to be late, or this didn't happen, or I have overpromised yet again, then also some sort of explanation is owed. But then that gets into, here's the explanation, and, you know, this thing, I'm back at the doctor again, or, you know, my sleep machine broke and I haven't actually slept in 2 weeks, or things like that, you know? And it's like, everybody has shit like that happen in their life sometimes. So, and the problem is, as soon as you start spelling that out, then you get into this whole, like, it's really easy to just, you know, dump as soon as you open the floodgate and say, look, this is what I'm dealing with right now. And it is so hard. And let me tell you, it doesn't feel fair, and I'm frustrated. And, you know, it's really easy to just get into that self-performance thing. Everybody does it. We all, you know, as soon as someone starts listening to us and they say, you know, how are you feeling today? And it's like, I'm having a hard day. And it's, oh, what's going on? Well, I got this phone call this morning from my doctor's office. And let me tell you, it's so unfair. And I just can't deal with it. And you just sort of, that stuff just sort of flows out because somebody is listening. Thing about being a content creator is it creates the illusion that people are always listening. But the thing is, nobody wants to read that crap, and I do try to remember it, and I'm sorry that sometimes I don't, because I'm human too, and life happens, and I'm trying to deal with being a human. Speaking of dealing with a human, I'm going to jump into a personal appeal here, okay? Earlier this year, my cousin Raymond and his new wife, they gave birth to a little baby girl. She's basically born with an underdeveloped liver. Okay. And she has been in and out of hospitals. They've been trying to stabilize her. It's reached the point now. She is going to need a liver transplant. And it's, you know, and obviously they're looking for a donor now. And, you know, I sadly don't qualify. I was just looking at the qualifications, and some of my chronic illnesses count me out. But I'm not asking anyway. Hey, like, so if you want to donate your liver for, you know, some asshole who writes pretend elf games on the internet, that's not what I'm saying. Okay. The family has posted a GoFundMe to help them defray some of the tremendous medical costs involved in this. And I posted it earlier today. I did not put it in the news and announcements, and I will not put it on my website itself, but I did put it out on my social media feeds. And unfortunately, I'm not very active on social media the way I used to be. So what I'm asking is, if you can, please spread the word. If you have any sort of social media, if you're on Instagrams or Twitters or anything, please just spread it around. Okay, I'm not even asking anybody to make a donation. You don't know her from Adam or anything, and you support me, and I'm greatly appreciative of that. And, you know, Angry Games has made a donation to help her also. So in some sense, you all already have. But, you know, just please help get the word out. And it's going really well. Okay, there has been a tremendous outpouring of support. So this is just a personal favor. Just please take a minute, check it out. Share it on social media, and that is done. That's the end of my appeal. Okay. This is less personal because at least it's associated with gaming, but I'm also going to spread this around. And this one, I'm going to put a more formal announcement out on, not on my website per se, not yet, though there might be plans, but definitely here in the Discord and stuff. My future in-laws, that is Allie's mother and stepfather, have actually started a board gaming podcast. It's been quite the journey with them. I was just listening to their first episode, where I actually get sort of, just an aside mention, by the by, but, you know, brand new podcast. They have two episodes out with another episode being edited and coming out soon. And then they're going to try and do two a month. So if you enjoy board games at all, you will want to check out chasing meeples. You know, and, you know, just give them a listen and see if you enjoy it. Okay? And thank you also, Nitsua, for posting the link. I was going to post the link to the GoFundMe. Okay. So all of that. Wow, the live chat Q&A thread is kind of quiet. So by the way, we do have a Q&A thread going. So if you want to ask any questions or propose any topics, go ahead and add them to the thread. Please don't add things that aren't questions or topics to the live chat thread. Otherwise, it will tremendously distract me. Let's see, and what else? Oh, the other thing is, Nitsua, once again, is hosting the Angry Bingo thing, which I probably should have announced like 10 minutes ago at the start of this. But, you know, so go ahead and grab your bingo card. He posted a thingy. He posted in the live chat here. So go ahead and grab your bingo card if you haven't already and start bingoing and you win a book from Nitsua. I have nothing. It's pinned. Yeah, it is in the pins. I pinned it. So yeah, I have nothing to do with that. I'm not giving away prizes or anything. This is all Nitsua is doing. Let's see. I'm trying to think. So some fun shit. Can we talk fun shit? Like this, you know, one of the things I've realized is I have, you know, like gaming, I'm not spending enough time talking about the fun and the positive anymore. It's starting to weigh on me. So, okay. One thing is, your Allie's stepfather, Chris, host of the new podcast, Chasing Meeples, and I have started playing a campaign in this board game called Role Player Adventures. And I'm going to post links to this because I'm going to post links to the other one first. Okay, so first of all, I got to mention Role Player because I really love this board game. Okay, now I am not a board game guy. So I'm not going to say, like, this is a worker placement draft, you know, Dutch-English Euro non-elimination thingy. Okay? But Role Player is a fun-as-hell game where you are you're trying to build the bestest character. Okay? And it is steeped in D&D classic Munchkin character generation. Okay, the idea is you have a character board, and the main thing you're trying to do is manipulate dice and fill in your attribute scores. So you'll pull dice of different colors, roll them, and place them for your strength, dexterity, constitution, place three in a row, and then they add up to a certain score. You're trying to get certain specific scores and to get colors of certain dice in specific places and also manipulate your alignment to match your background and buy just the right equipment and just the right skills and traits and do all of this so that you can make the bestest character in true Munchkin fashion. It's a really, really fun game of dice manipulation. There's a lot of different things to do with it. You know, like you can go at it from your ability scores. You can go at it from the dice colors, alignment traits. There's different strategies that you can formulate depending on how the game is playing out. And you often have to adjust your strategy at the same time. There's a little bit of interaction because there's a market and you're buying resources from the market and everybody has to share the same resources or the same market. So, you know, and the dice. So you're drafting the dice, you're drafting cards from the market, stuff like that. It's a really, really fun tongue-in-cheek game. Nitsua is pointing out Call to Adventure, which is a fun game that is not anything like this because this is extremely tongue-in-cheek and also mechanically focused. And Call to Adventure is a totally straight-laced attempt to build a fascinating backstory for your character based on a three-act structure. That said, I also totally recommend Call to Adventure. It is also a ton of fun, but it's not dice manipulating, making fun of Munchkin gaming, build the bestest character fun. And that's what I'm talking about here. And it's important for this story because we started playing this new thing called Role Player Adventures. The idea is you take the character that you made in Roleplayer, though you don't have to. You can also just, it's a standalone game and you can create your own thing. And it is a campaign style game where you play through, it's a cooperative, adventure-y, dungeon crawly, go on an adventure, you know, game of campaign play for 1 to 4 people to team up and take on one adventure after another. Okay. And it is built on the characters that you build in Role Player. It is also heavily based on fidgety dice manipulation, which is really fun. So the main way that you deal with challenges is by pulling colored dice from a bag blindly, rolling them, and then trying to use cards to manipulate the colors and the numbers to get the right colors and numbers you need to overcome the challenge. Okay, it's very abstract. Okay, the combat doesn't feel like combat, and the overcoming skills does not feel like you're actually doing anything. It's very clearly that you're playing with dice. You're just manipulating the hell out of dice. Okay, but it is a ton of fun, and the way the game is put together is it's in this series of choose your own adventure modules. And I'm going to go ahead and post the link to this now. And I'm calling this out for a really specific, interesting reason. Okay. So actually two reasons. One is tonal dissonance. And the other one is there's something I really want to check out about this. So Role Player Adventures, campaign-based game, comes with like 10 scenarios in the box. You play through each one. Each one is structured as a choose-your-own-adventure style game where you go to different locations on a map, and when you get to this location, you read this passage, and then it presents you choices and options. And one of the things that's really interesting about it, too, is it almost has a point-and-click adventure game feel because you can find items in the game and then use those items at particular locations, and there's a way of stringing together the numerical codes on the items to find the passages in the book so that you can even combine two items together. So like in the adventure we were playing last night, we had a staff sling and this runed ball of elven silver that we ended up ultimately using to fling at a bell that was out of reach to ring it and open a door. Okay, now, as interesting and fascinating as that sounds, it doesn't quite have the feel of like solving an actual puzzle. And here's why. You don't actually have to know what you're trying to do with the item in order to use the item at a location. A location will give you the option to say, do you want to use any items? And then you can use any of the items the party has by stringing together the numerical codes and looking up the proper passage. And each scenario is designed so that each item that it is possible to have in that scenario has passages for all the different locations. Okay, and most of it is just flavor text. Like if you use the staff sling in town, it's like you look at the staff sling and it is a staff sling and you wonder who could have left this here, stuff like that. But then you use the items at specific locations and then certain things will happen. And while you can be clever and think maybe, well, when we do this, you'll it'll fix this, you know, that's like we literally did think, oh, we have the staff sling, we have this silver ball, and there is that bell, and we need to ring it to open this door. What if we use staff sling with bell, or use staff sling with ball, right? And that's why I say it's got a point and click adventure game feel, because if they, what you're really doing is just rubbing all your items on the different locations to see which ones do what, and you really have no idea what the book is going to think you were trying to do with the item. Like at one point, just for out of curiosity, we used a shovel and that elven ball of silver in town. And the book's interpretation of that is whiffing the ball up into the air, smacking it with the shovel like you're playing baseball, and then we pelted it through a halfling's window and were charged some money to replace the window. I shit you not. Okay, so it's got kind of the point-and-click adventure feel where you click use item and you never actually know what's going to happen. You're just trying to jump on the train of logic. Okay. Two things about this game. I recommend it. It's really fun. It's really interesting. And the writing is actually surprisingly nuanced at times. Like, there is a conflict between an invading army and the Empire, and ostensibly you are serving the Empire, but it becomes clear that the invading army all is not what it seems. I'll just say that. All is not what it seems. And maybe the invading army has a point, which, you know, and also the empire has, like, you know, you don't know yet because you're playing through these scenarios. But there are times where the game lets you side with the three different factions that are in play. It doesn't assume that you're going to play just one path through, which means it seems really, really, really replayable. Here's the problem with it, okay? I'm doing a compliment sandwich here because I'm going to end on a compliment too. So all of that, that's good. The gameplay's fun, especially if you wish you could play a choose-your-own-adventure book with a point-and-click adventure game with a role-player character you made yourself and pretend you're playing D&D. Because that's ultimately what you're... Let's pretend we're playing a role-playing game because you're not, right? Okay. Where it doesn't work is that there is a real weirdness with the tone. Okay, first of all, role-player was a tongue-in-cheek game. It was made to, it was made basically to make fun of that whole Munchkin idea of, you know, making the mechanically bestest character, right? And like, it's clearly goofy because the cards don't mean anything. Like, you can have these weird skills and these weird backstories, and it really doesn't matter that you're like your backstory is just a word. And your class and your race, they're just words. You only care about them insofar as the bonuses go. So you can play like an Chris is playing like a, he's playing a psychopathic paladin with an unholy flail, who I think was lawful good. Though, yeah. So, like, okay, you know, clearly it's not a role-play game. Okay. The problem is role-player adventures. The adventures are written with some pretty serious themes and decisions. There's some moral dilemmas. There's interesting decisions. There's a mystery. It's worthy of it's worthy of a role-playing game plot. Okay, there's obviously a fully developed world with a history because it keeps revealing the history. I don't know how detailed or deep the history is. But at the same time, the game itself that it's based on is tongue-in-cheek. Not only that, the game still tries to have these humor elements. So, you know, we're hunting down a troll that has been murdering people and a kidnapped halfling girl. And meanwhile, there's this mysterious treasure hunter that is stealing ancient artifacts. And the invading army also seems to be hunting for these ancient artifacts that they may have some sort of like... you know, like ancestral claim on. And it's like, okay, this is all pretty big and deep and, you know, people are sad and whatever. And then it throws shit at you like, and then you throw the ball up into the air and knock it through a window. And then the halfling's like, what did you do? You broke my window. You give me 5 gold coins. And like, it's tonally kind of a mess. And I think part of the problem is role player was never meant to be taken seriously. And then role player adventures was a response to, hey, it would be nice if there was a game where we could do something with these characters we built. Because there were a couple of expansions for role player that added more phases to the game, like hunting monsters and beating a boss. You're like going on your first dungeon adventure. So role player adventures is the natural outgrowth of that. What I find most interesting though, and I haven't looked at it yet, because I don't want to spoiler anything until I've played through a bit more. There is an instruction manual for how to write a module for role player adventures. Like literally how to write the choose your own adventure setup, how to design a map, how to do all this shit. And apparently there's even some licensing stuff. So it's really fascinating. And that caught my eye. And I mean, there's a, I just glanced through the adventure writing interest in information. And there's even a style guide in there, like, look, use this terminology, not this terminology. This is how you format stuff. But there's also advice on structuring their adventures. I wouldn't suggest reading the how to build one until you actually play one of the scenarios. Because you really do need to see how these things are put together. It is a really fascinating way. It's put together like a game book, only more so. Okay? Like the old, like the Lone Wolf game books, or the what was the ones by Steve Jackson? Not that one, but the other one. All the fighting fantasy books. Yeah. So anyway. So yeah, check out Role Player as just a fun game, and check out Role Player Adventures if you want to drop, like, what the hell was it? Like $150 on a giant campaign play box. And you'll probably get, like, it looks like, based on the speed we're going through this, we're probably going to get about 3 months of play out of just the base game. And then I am going to be really fascinated to check out the how to write adventure stuff after that. Once we get a few modules ahead of the first adventure, then I want to open up one of the adventure modules and read it beginning to end and see how it's put together. It's just really interesting. Anyway, with all of that said, so that was a half hour of me gabbling along about nothing in particular except a board game I happened to play. But, you know, that was fun and some other stuff. So let's see. Any questions or comments? Now is the time to throw them in the questions and comment thread. And please, someone other than Natsua, throw some comments, because he always throws these questions. Because he always throws these questions I have no idea how to answer. Okay. Noided is asking, what's the deal with charisma? And I can't help, every time someone starts a question with, what's the deal with, I always hear that 90s comedian, like the Seinfeld type comedian. It's like, somebody tell me, what's the deal with charisma? It's a moon, but it's yeah, I can't think of anything. So what is the deal with charisma? It's a very interesting question. Charisma is, of course, the red moon. It is one of the two moons in the Angryverse, which I recently revealed in the article that went into early access, I think, yesterday. My world has two moons, right? One of them is the silvery blue moon, Azura, and the other one is the red moon, Charisma. And Azura behaves just like a normal moon would. It has a 28-day cycle, and, you know, and it's the nice moon, and everybody likes it. You know, it's silver, it's blue, yada, yada, yada. Then there's Charisma, the red moon, that everybody is terrified of because it's the evil moon. And the most unique thing about Charisma is that it moves through its phases at a random rate. Okay, so it goes from it goes through the phases in order. It doesn't skip phases or do anything crazy like that. Though it has been implied that it doesn't always rise and set at the same time or in the same location. So yeah, I don't know if that's true or not. It was implied by one thing one sailor said in one adventure. Okay, and that right there is why it is very hard for me to tell you what the deal with charisma actually is. Because the world has not yet revealed to me what the deal with charisma is, or even whether the world is ever going to reveal what the deal with charisma is. Okay, this is something that I have absolutely no problem with. A lot of GMs are allergic to this idea. It is okay to have things in your world that even you do not know, okay? And in fact, that makes the world more wonderful and more mysterious, okay? Now, there are theories in the world. In a previous campaign, some of my players were exploring ancient ruins that belong to Draconians, because I'm running 3.5, so this is before Dragonborn, and there's no Dragonborn playable race, but I did imply that in ancient times, in the Age of Legends or some shit like that, there was some kind of half-dragon race, and they worshipped two goddesses, and they found a lot of imagery that was associated with the moon, and that party started to surmise that Bahamut, the queen of sea and sky, was probably associated with the silvery blue moon Azura, and Tiamat, the queen of flame and blood, was probably associated with the red moon. It was also implied that there used to just be one moon, and that it was sundered in ancient times, and gave rise to these two draconic gods. And the moons may be those draconic gods. Of course, those gods have been lost to history and no one seriously believes in them anymore. Maybe dragons do, but I haven't asked dragons about their beliefs yet. Okay. And this, again, is the key point. I don't do world building. I wait for the world to reveal itself. Okay. All I know right now is there is, I know some stuff about Chrisma. I know Chrisma is the moon that controls lycanthropes, which, by the way, that makes being cursed with lycanthropy a lot more scary because you don't know when it's going to cycle. The very least, you know, you had a lawful good person who got cursed with werewolfness. Then when they knew the full moon was coming, they would go chain themselves in a cabin in the middle of nowhere where they couldn't hurt anybody, you know, with some goats to eat for 3 days and wait through the full moon, right? But if the red moon Chrisma is the one that controls lycanthropy, then you have no idea when the full moon is coming, or how long it's going to last or anything like that. And that's a lot more fun. Also, Chrisma is generally associated with evil magic, and wizards, when they cast detect magic, if Chrisma is in the sky, they can feel Chrisma as part of their magical third eye. Why? I don't know. I don't know what the hell it is. I know it's associated with chaos, I know it's associated with magic, and I know the entire world is afraid of Chrisma. You know, it's all the bad superstitions. And on the night when Azura is new and Chrisma is full, it's considered to be an unlucky night to do basically anything. And wizards especially are wary of casting spells when Chrisma is full and Azura is new. But beyond that, I don't know what the deal is. Someday I might. Maybe I'll never know. It's better if I never know. You know? Anyway. What board game you've played feels most like or reminds you most of tabletop role-playing game play? None of them. Board games aren't role-playing games. Okay? This is not me just being flippant and saying if you want to play a role-playing game, play a role-playing game. Although I could. This is Nitsua's question, by the way. What board game you've played feels most like tabletop role-playing game play? What is inherent to tabletop role-playing games is that they are games without the constraints that other games are forced to labor under. Okay, the major constraint being without a human brain actively redesigning the play experience in response to what the players do, you do not have a role-playing game. Therefore, the minute you say board game, I'm going to say it does not feel anything like a role-playing game because a role-playing game's feeling is distinctly tied to the fact that it is the one kind of game that is unconstrained by the limitations of having to be designed and then just thrown in front of people. So this is not a sarcastic answer, okay? This is a very serious answer. This cuts to the heart of what a role-playing game is. Okay, you cannot have a board game that feels like a role-playing game. You can't. Okay, thus, if you want the experience of playing a role-playing game, play a role-playing game. Should you have players do the character introduction description when you are running a game with a tight time limit for a convention? No. Or make them very much abbreviate it. Look, every piece of advice I give is always with the caveat of unless your situation provides a really good, strong reason to do otherwise. Okay? Look, the common play experience is you're going to have 3 to 4 hours of play and you're going to meet every week or every 2 weeks or some shit like that. Okay, that's how role-playing games mostly work. If you, the farther you deviate from that, the less my advice is going to work. Unless the advice I'm giving is some, like I did write an article about, here's how to write a game that you're only going to play once at a convention for 3 hours, right? But, you know, in the normal role-playing game experience, we're assuming that it's an ongoing game for at least a couple of weeks, you know, several weeks. Same players show up every week, yada, yada, yada. It's not West March's bullshit or anything like that. If you're not running that kind of game, then you've got to look at everything that you would do at a normal game and say, is this worth the time? 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 The problem is you're going to be cutting out all of the things that make the campaign ongoing role-playing game experience feel like it does. So with every cut of everything you have to make, you are sacrificing some of the experience. But then you know that because I'm running a you're running a game for a tight time limit like a convention. That's not how role-playing games are meant to be run. So you're going to have to cut shit out. And that's just the way it is. So no. Any off-the-beaten-path Thanksgiving traditions? No. I don't have any. We get together, we do the turkey and the stuffing and the mashed potatoes, and, you know, we overeat, and then we have 17 different desserts on the table, and we all... Though, this day and age, I guess I could say my off-the-beaten Thanksgiving tradition is to actually spend some time reflecting on what I'm grateful for in my life, which I don't think nearly enough people do. So that's kind of an off-the-beaten-path tradition. But other than that, no, our Thanksgivings are very traditional. I'm actually a very traditional guy, okay? I am very traditional in many, many ways. Wes Belmont, what is that short desk you mentioned? Ah, an excellent question. And I'm really sorry that it was something that I meant. It's not gone, okay? It's coming in January. It's coming as part of the new Angry Essentials line of articles. But because you're all so nice, I'm going to give you just a preview. Okay. It's part of how to interact with your players at the table. Okay. The basic technique runs like this. You're always talking to your players and you're always talking about your characters. And that's a good mode of speech to get into. Hey, Bob, what does Bogar do? Bogar is a great name. I can't come up with names on the fly now. Okay, Bob, what does Bogar do? Alice, it's, you know, Kara's turn. What does Kara do? Yada, yada, yada. What, right? Like, all that shit. Okay, so, basically, the short desk is the, this comes from a way back when online gaming was confined to text-based games. Okay, MUDs, MUSHes, MUCs, MOOs. They were all acronyms for multi-user whatever. And it was basically just a text-based game that multiple people would connect to at once. You would type in your commands, and then it would play like a text-based game, but with interaction, right? If you built one of those, there were certain terms that you learned, and one of them was the short desk. Okay, and it's short for short description, because everything had a name, a short description, and a long description, right? And the name was the term that would be used in commands. And then the short description was what would show up if it was in the room. And then the long description was what it would show up if somebody actually examined the thing. So let's take Aliara. Aliara, the elven warrior, that might be, or Aliara might be her name, right? And then her long description would be, Aliara is an elf of average height, which means she stands under 5 feet tall and is built with slender grace, and yada, long brown, autumn brown hair with a hint of bronze and piercing purple eyes, and shit like that, right? The long description. The short description is what would show up when you walked into the room and she was there, she would be listed. And assuming you didn't know her name, you would see the elven warrior, right? Elven warrior or female elven warrior or something like that, right? That's a short description. why am I bothering to explain this shit? Because it's a really good thing for you to do as a GM is to occasionally not refer to the characters at the table or in the scene, including the NPCs, by name, but rather descriptively. So I might say, Bob, what does Beauregard do? And Beauregard will say, Beauregard's going to run forward and attack the goblin. The dwarven warrior rears back with his warhammer and swings, roll your attack, okay, you know, a solid blow driving back the sniveling goblin, right? Okay, there I didn't, in my descriptive text, I didn't say Beauregard. I referred to him as the dwarven warrior. I might refer to him as the dwarf. I might refer to him as the cleric. Okay, there's all these little, it's almost like pronouns. Okay, pronouns for characters. Like, you just sometimes replace the character's name with something descriptive that reminds people of what's being played, right? It reminds people of what they're dealing with. And you just build it as a habit as a GM. When you're referring to characters, don't always call them by name. Okay, and there was a whole speech that Kevin Smith gave. This is a hilarious speech, by the way. I will turn it up so that I can link it, unless someone already does. Kevin Smith told the story of when he was brought in to write a script for one of the Superman Returns, the Death and Return of Superman or whatever. And he was working with, what the hell's the producer's name? Peters? I can't remember the producer's first name. The guy who ended up producing Wild Wild West, which was sort of the punchline of the whole speech. Right? Okay. The movie Wild Wild West. Anyway, John Peters. Right? So Kevin Smith is brought in to work with John Peters, who it turns out is a complete wackadoodle. Find this speech online. Somebody turned it, it went viral years ago. And it's just him giving a talk at, I think, Comic-Con. And it's like, here's my experience working with John Peters. Hilarious shit. But one of the things he says is that he's reading his script to John Peters and he's writing Superman. And he says, when you're writing a script about Superman, you end up saying Superman a lot. And you don't want to keep saying Superman. So I inserted all these other phrases, like I would, you know, I would refer to him like the son of Krypton, the boy of destiny, yada, yada, yada. Like he had like 17 different nicknames for Superman, Kal-El. And at one point, John Peters interrupted him. He's like, wait, who the F is Kal-El? It's like, oh, Superman. You know, and it was like, they had to have this conversation. But anyway, that little thing stuck in my head of this whole, you don't want to keep using the name because it gets repetitive. And it glommed onto the, people sometimes forget that people are playing weird races and classes and things like that, or whatever they are, right? So sometimes you just kind of sneak that in, you know, just work short descriptions in instead of describing everybody by name all the time, you know? The reason, by the way, to not just, like I used to refer to players by their character name. I would say, okay, you know, Beauregard, what are you doing? And that worked well enough at a live table, and it was very immersive, and my players enjoyed that. But when I started running games online, I discovered that people had a tendency to forget you were talking to them. So I would say, okay, you know, what's Beauregard do? Or Beauregard, what do you do? And, you know, nothing. Just, it's like, oh, right, that's me. And then Bob would speak up. And in fact, in general, over the last couple of weeks, actually over the last 2 months or so, I have been changing my mode of communication deliberately to do things like to call players by name whenever I need to address them, instead of just saying, and now it's, you know, Beauregard's turn. What does Beauregard do? I will say, Bob, it is Beauregard's turn. What does Beauregard do? And I will lead with Bob. And then 2 minutes later, I will always say, okay, Bob, you're muted. So if you're talking, we can't hear you. Because, you know, that's how you run an online game, is everybody's always muted until you remind them they are muted. But anyway, and then that's, and then I started, the short description habit was something that I had done off and on for a long time. But putting it all together, I sort of came up with a formula for talking to players. And it has actually sort of improved the flow of my online game, which is something I have been struggling to do for many, many years, was just in the way I address people. This is also tied into the idea of the principal character. Or, you know, because, you know, I know some people use the idea of the caller, but it is time to replace that outmoded garbage because you don't need a caller. You just need to understand who the principal character is. So anyway, there is an entire article coming in January that will have to do with narration. Not the, what it's the topic is the call to action. Okay. When it is after. It is what happened. It is how you get the player to say what they do when you say, okay, what do you do? And the reason that it got pushed off January is twofold. One has to do with the sort of angry renaissance that is happening in January. But the other is I'm still experimenting with some shit in my online game as to how it flows. But one of the things that really surprised me is I had started working on this online flow thing and how to communicate better to make the game flow, because online games flow like shit. They flow, you know, not like they flow like, you know, molasses in January is how they flow. Or they flow like, you know, a teenager who's having their first driving lesson and they have 1 foot on the brake and 1 foot on the gas pedal. That is how an online game flows. So I've been trying to fix that problem now for months, and my inconsistent schedule does not help that at all. I took those techniques to NonCon and ran my games using the same ideas. And no less than three people came up to me after the games were done, of the games I ran, and said, hey, I really liked how you use both the player name and the character name and how you do this and how you do this. So people were actually noticing the narration, which told me I might have hit on something that is not just good for online games, but also that may really improve meat space games, or as I like to call them, real actual games worth playing. Anyway, so Wes Belmont, I think your answer was somewhere in there. Procellus, hope you have a good Thanksgiving. Hope you have a good Thanksgiving too. I hope you all have a good Thanksgiving, those of you who celebrate. And those of you who don't celebrate, I also hope that your Thursday is nice, because I just wish a good day on you, okay? And of course, you know, part of my Thanksgiving is making sure that I reflect on the things that I am grateful for. And one of the things I'm grateful for most is all of the people sitting here now listening to me, listening to this recording, reading all of my articles, supporting me, of course. And, you know, everybody who has just, you know, been encouraging me and been on my team these last couple of months and forever. Sword Person. A few live chats ago, someone asked you about Five Torches Deep and you confused it with Torchbearer and went on a rant about how Torchbearer is bad. Are you aware of Five Torches Deep? And if so, what is your opinion about it? Well, here's the funny thing about that. You're right. I did get Five Torches Deep and Torchbearer bad because in my mind, they're both awful, terrible dungeon crawling games I never want to run again. So they're very, very similar in that respect. The major difference is in the page count. Five Torches Deep is much more to the point. It only takes like 20 pages to suck, whereas I had to buy an entire Torchbearer to get the suckage out of that thing. An entire hardback. So... Five Torches Deep, first of all, it is not, yeah, as you point out, okay, to be fair, you have said, you have been very fair, and you pointed out, Sword Person, that Five Torches Deep is a set of house rules to 5e to make it play more like the OSR. And while I agree that it is indeed a set of house rules to 5e, I disagree that it made it entirely clear. And also kind of like one of the big problems I ran into with Five Torches Deep right off the bat is it's not clear how much of 5e you're supposed to keep. It does provide some house rules, but if you just apply those house rules to a game that is otherwise 5e in every respect, it fails to deliver anything it promises. So it is a set of house rules to 5e, assuming you mutilate 5e and rip out huge numbers of pages first, and you're knowledgeable enough to know which pages to rip out. So that is my first objection, is that it's not really clear how you're supposed to use it. Okay, it's just, here's a pile of house rules. That's nice, but it needs to go into more detail. The second thing is, it has a few too many abstracty, fiddly mechanics for me to say, yeah, this feels like old school. Okay? Because one of the things about old school was basically we all ignored the mechanics. Okay? It was, you know, I would sit there and bounce a d20 occasionally, but mostly it was just, you know, well, what do you do? Well, okay, you try this, this is what I... And there, you know, the you want to catch the old school feel, it's like play without rules. Okay? Play without rules and, you know, be mean-spirited. But anyway, and the thing is, Five Torches Deep has all these fiddly little bits that don't really try to make sense in the world because they're abstractions, because they're attempts to do mechanical things. And that seems to me to be the opposite of the OSR. And I'll give you a perfect example. The crazy encumbrance and supply rules. Okay, they are exceedingly abstract. And based on, the idea of intelligence determining... your stash of supplies on the logic that it, you know, more intelligent people will think to bring more shit. And it's like, here's the thing. In the old days in old school, if you wanted to bring a thing, what determined whether you were smart enough to bring it is whether you, the player, were smart enough to bring it. Okay, so the idea of the abstract mechanic of, well, your character is smarter than you. We didn't worry about that shit, okay? Old school never worried. Well, what if I want to play a character that's smarter than me? Well, you fucking can't, because you're not smart enough, okay? At the end of the day, it's your brain in the character's body. And what intelligence does is very limited, and what all the ability scores was done was very limited. Right? Each ability score, it would give a specific set of bonuses, penalties, and target numbers to certain things. Like your strength would give you a bonus to melee attack and melee damage, and your chance to bend bars and lift gates, and things like that. And that was it. And anything that wasn't described by strength, that was up to the GM. So... yeah, I don't think Five Torches Deep delivers on its promise to be more old school. It actually felt really, really abstract in the same way that Fourth Edition did. So I think it was misguided, and I think it is badly explained. Rob, is the time pool diagram your solution to keeping track of time? Sort of. A diagram is not a solution. Okay, a diagram is a tool for implementing a solution. Okay, so this one you're just going to have to wait and see. And I have a 5-minute warning now. I don't want to end at 5 minutes. How many more questions do I have? Yeah, okay. I got 5 minutes to answer 2 questions. Okay, in a world that doesn't scale with the PCs, how can you warn players in world that a monster or task is far beyond their skills at the moment? Whoa. I don't know. You know, let one of them take a hit. Like, I mean, you could just warn them. If this is the game you want to play, okay? If the game you want to play is where you tell the players, like, okay, here's this thing. It's too powerful for you, so you have to run away from it. Like, then just say it. You know, don't beat around the bush. Don't hide it. That's what you're doing. You want to set down some challenges that the players aren't allowed to take on until they've earned other challenges yet, and that's how you want to run your world, then you owe it to your players to be honest about that and just say it flat out. Look, I put this thing here. It's way too badass for you. You just can't handle it. Okay? You know, because that's ultimately what you're doing anyway, right? And if you don't want your world to scale with the PCs, then you have 2 choices. One is you warn them, or 2 is let them make the discoveries for themselves, which will usually amount to them getting pasted. Then again, you know, if you're running 5e, like, they can take a hit or two. Like, okay, one PC dies, that pretty much proves the situation is serious. It's like, okay, that dragon one-shotted the fighter beyond his three saves and turned him into paste. Everyone else is like, we gotta run away, you know? Okay, does the separation... Rob is asking... Oh, that was Stu, by the way. I haven't been asking reading names, I think. So Stu asked, in the world that doesn't scale with EPCs, yada, yada, yada. Rob, this is going to be my final question. So, producer, don't mute me. Give me a chance to run to answer this question. Do not let me go more than 5 minutes over time, though. Okay. Does the separation between stuff that is true in the world and stuff Angry knows about the world rely on the players? You said you haven't asked dragons what they think, but would it be more accurate to say the players have never been in a position to ask any dragons? No. No, because I certainly know things about the world that the players don't. Okay? But those things have, you know, those things have been revealed to me. Okay? Usually because I think they might come up, or just because an idea occurs to me. Okay, there is stuff I know about the world that is just sort of soft and wishy-washy. It's stuff I'm pretty sure of about the world. Okay? Like, I'm pretty sure I know how the major goddess of the Al-Qadi religion relates to the Vassar. Don't type another question. Nori is typing in the thread. There is no other questions or comments. This is the last one. Okay. And only because the idea popped in my head and it's too good to discard. So I kind of have the idea now of how those two religions relate, or how the supernatural entities that supposedly exist, as far as the players or as far as the people in the world know, I have an idea in my head. It might not come to pass. I have a lot of ideas in my head. So, you know, when the rubber hits the road and, you know, the players travel to the outer planes and actually start talking to angels, might be the answer will be something different. But for now, I'm pretty sure I have a soft answer. So, you know, and then, of course, because I have been running this world for years and building and building and building on it, there are things I know that my current players don't know. Also, the world does change and evolve over time. Like, honestly, it didn't even have two moons until... Oh, wait. It did have two moons, but I didn't know the red moon was crazy until a year and a half ago. So, anyway. Okay, so that's the answer. I'm being asked what time the recording started. Okay. According to my recording, I am at 57 minutes and 35 seconds right now. Okay, and that ultimately tells me where I'm actually at. So, that gives me roughly 2 minutes to say, thank you everybody for turning out. All right, hold on a second. Wait a minute. I feel really bad about Nori's question. So, Nori, you have 30 seconds to type your question. I'm going to do it. I'll take Proselus's power away if he tries to mute me. But you're going to get a lightning fast answer. So if it's a complicated question, you're going to be unsatisfied with the answer. Okay, so if you ask me to design, like, you know, an entire system for you, I don't even see you typing right now, Nori. So you're already failing at this. Okay, because you've got like 3 seconds left on my clock. Oh, good grief. Come on now. Tippity type away. Anyway, if it's complicated, you're going to be sad. How would you run a campaign that has two villains that are only in conflict with the players, that are not only in conflict with the players, but with each other? No differently than I would run any other campaign, the end. Okay, you run a campaign like this. You have villains. The players do things. You decide how the villains react. Okay? If you want to have the villains taking off-screen actions against each other, you just decide that. You sit down, you say, well, what would this villain do? His plans are, well, maybe he would make a raid on this villain. Well, okay, how? What would that affect? I don't know, you know, and just make shit up. That's what you do. You're a GM, you make shit up. Okay, that's it. No dice rolls, no doing weird tables off behind the screen, no fronts, no advancing things, no scores, no anything. Between sessions, you look at what the players did, you look at your world, you ask, okay, how would shit change? And you write that down, and the end. Whatever comes out of your head, that's your answer. Doesn't matter if you've got two villains or 10 or 30 factions or whatever. Oh, the players fucked up the villain's plan. What would the villain do? The villain would do this now. There we go. Done and done. And then you let your game designer take a look at it and say something like, okay, but if the villain did that, then it's going to be a TPK. Then you say, oh, okay, we'll scale it back. But the idea is there. It's like, okay, the villain would launch an attack on the players. Okay. Which is much different than saying the villain would unleash a 30th level beholder assassin on the players, okay? But that's what you do. Just make shit up, okay? You don't have to do anything. When you are not running the game, when the players are not saying, I do this, and then you say, okay, roll the die. This is what happens. You can do anything you want, and you should, okay? The end. Thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been my Mostly Monthly Live Chat for the month of November. I will be back in a month for the Mostly Monthly Live Chat of December, which will be the Christmas episode. And I haven't decided what I'm going to do for the Christmas episode yet. And I'm probably not going to do anything different. So everybody just be prepared to ask questions, make comments. And good night.